Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. It's been a huge week in the world of cricket, with three test matches, including one of the greatest of all time, loads of county action, some changes of coaches, some big moments in the associate world, and plenty else besides. And we've got a bumper episode this week to keep you covered. In the words of Joe Root, test cricket is alive and kicking, and this series is alive and kicking as well. Phil and Joe, where were you when?
Right, I was in North London at Tottenham Hotspur's new football stadium. Forgive me, but that's where I was. I set off just after lunch when Bairstow had just nicked off, which felt like a kind of critical moment anyway, and I was quite comfortable with walking away. I'd explained to my girlfriend as well at the time, look, I can't watch this afternoon, it'll be too hellish, so let's go and watch the football instead. So set off, and walking through the streets, it was like the ECB had commissioned an advert showing how popular cricket is. The sun was out, everybody was bouncing along, checking their phones, listening into their earpieces. There was a buzz for cricket, which is not my imagination. It was palpable on the tubes, on the streets, got the bus up to North London, and it was everywhere. Then we were walking down, went to the pub, saw the penultimate wicket fall. Again, shrugged my shoulders, moved on. 70-odd needed, one wicket to go, don't worry about it, moved on. Walking up Seven Sisters Road, and you'd hear these kind of strangulated roars here and there, and I'm thinking, it can't be the Man City Bournemouth game, it can't be that, no one cares about that. Got to the ground, and it was about 20 minutes till kickoff, and Stokes was two overs from immortality, and the ground was heaving with cricket. And every bar, and famously Tottenham has all these bars all around the edges, 60-yard bar, every screen had the cricket on. Didn't have anything else, didn't have the team news, didn't have the end of the City game or anything like that. It just had cricket, and the place was going berserk. It was stunning to watch. And it was almost kind of more powerful for it being a non-cricketing setting to have seen this thing take place. And then it was announced on the PA system once everybody got into the ground, and it was talked about at half-time as well. And it was almost like the football, thankfully, was incidental. We don't need to dwell on that. Oddly, in a slightly sort of perverse way, it was the ideal place to witness it happening because it was wrenched out of cricket's little comfort zones and cricket's catchment areas and taken into a place which is where cricket really wants to be. It wants to be, you know, kind of the beating heart of ordinary sports lovers' lives. And there it was. It will stay with everybody, of course, but it will stay with me for the unusualness of where I saw it.
Yeah, and Joe, can you top that?
Well, mine was not the ideal place to watch it. It's quite a poor reflection of two so-called cricket writers that we were just doing other things on
we
this
We can't
on
be
this
at all of
day.
Them,
But
Joe.
Ben was at Headingley. He was covering all bases for us. I was actually in Bermondsey brewing a beer for my cousin's wedding, as you do on a Sunday. And similarly, I thought, overnight, I thought maybe they'd given us a little chance. And then by lunch, I was like, I thought they'd lose it in the first hour. When they hadn't, we had to leave for brewing at about 12:30. Which I really didn't want to go and do at that stage. And we had a French guy who was teaching us how to brew our lovely pale ale for the wedding, who had barely heard of cricket, certainly didn't know what the Ashes was. But we had a tablet up behind his head as he was talking us through the different varieties of hops, seeing wicket after wicket go. But then even by the end, he was caught up in the whole drama thing. The brewing got forgotten about for a couple of hours. Actually, I don't still understand the process that well because I wasn't listening. But if you do it slowly, if you funnel it out slowly, the alcohol content rises. So it's meant to be a 4.5% beer. It's actually a 5.5% beer just on the basis of Ben Stokes, basically, because we just lost track of what was going on.
Did you name your beer?
It's still up for grabs. I mean, maybe we can put this out to listeners. Yeah. It's got to be... The groom is a massive cricket fan, so it's fine for it to be cricket.
Right.
So something Stokes related, something Headingley related, all up for grabs. So do please send in your suggestions.
Yeah. All right, watch them flooding in.
If it was cider, Jack Leach would be the perfect name for it, but
he would.
Doesn't quite fit a beer, does he?
I don't want to go back again. It took about 6 hours to do it.
Just for a contrived little bit in a podcast.
And we've got to go back in 3 weeks to bottle up like 300 bottles of this stuff. It's hard work brewing.
Yeah, my heart goes out to you, Joe. Yeah. It really does. Yeah, it was beautiful. What was the atmosphere like? Had it all gone totally postal by this point in the the press box.
Did you kiss Paul Newman on the head like Phil did after the World Cup victory?
No.
And Lawrence Booth squarely on the lips as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, no, I didn't get any action. So that's a shame. it was incredible in the press box, but also Headingley just has an amazing atmosphere to watch cricket in.
It did look astonishing.
Yeah, I think the thing is that you get it's a sort of a democratic ground in that you've got sections for every area. So you've got your anoraks over in one corner, and the Western Terrace, they are boozing and absolutely steaming at all stages, but they also absolutely love their cricket and know what's going on at every stage, even if they don't know what else is going on.
It's not just the kind of football chanting that you get a couple of other
exactly
grounds.
Yeah, Lords, you get the hum because no one really is paying attention, they're just
that's
there
the snoozing
like a, yeah, and then the Oval is like a great atmosphere, but it's like, again, people come for a bit of a drink and the cricket can be incidental, but at Headingley they love it and they love a drink, and it was an incredible atmosphere. I don't know how it compared to the World Cup final. I guess neither of us were in both press boxes, so it's hard to tell, but kind of just two of a kind, I guess.
And the press have gone for Stokes now, haven't they? In the way that we always dreamt that they would go for him, and not in the way that they once did 2 years ago. And however rather naff and cosmetic it is, it still brings a smile, because we've always known that of all this era of English cricketers, he's the one. He's the one with that kind of innate ability to take it through to a different kind of level. And Jofra may come in his slipstream by chance, by coincidence really, but it's Stokes who's always threatened it, and Stokes who's now gone ahead and done it.
I've really enjoyed having a couple of people, a couple of family members, a couple of friends who don't really know cricket say to me, I just thought he was that thug. I thought he was that thug who could play a bit of cricket. And it's not only that they've seen that he wins matches, but there's the kind of the manner that he did it with, also that he had Leach as his sidekick. It was, obviously the perfect narrative, and we are changing some people's minds about the game and about Ben Stokes.
Just finally, my mum was watching it all glued to her TV, she was. An awesome joy indeed, fabulous and remarkable Ben Stokes. That's what she wrote.
Sounds like a Hallmark card.
An awesome joy. Yeah, by Wendy Walker.
Obviously, the last hour had the perfect narrative, but really it was the test match as a whole. I mean, on day one, you had Jofra Archer taking 6-45, his first test, 5 for Australia. Made
and bowling fast medium, deliberately.
Yeah, I know, incredible.
How cool was that?
Yeah, Australia made 180 despite having 100 partnership in that. So already in that day, it had swung back and forth. Day two at England, bowled out for 67, and then Ben Stokes started a spell of 24 and a bit overs with only a 4-ball gap.
Yeah, I hope in time the Stokes spell becomes a companion piece to the Stokes innings. Mm. We were watching it, Joe, in the pub, weren't we?
On Friday evening.
We're not painting a good picture of our professional faculties, in fairness. But yeah, it was the Friday evening. We caught the last hour or so in the pub, having watched it all day. And he was in the midst of how many overs off the reel?
I think it was 24.2 overs.
Did he bowl 13 that night? Was that right? Or 14 that night?
With a 4-ball gap, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and to be honest, there was a point there where it shows my defeatism. I thought the game was gone. I was basically like, well, don't bowl him into the ground. It felt like Stokes had the control over Root. Maybe Root was letting things slip. Stokes was taking over, just doing that thing where he says, well, no one else is doing it right, I'm just going to bowl all day.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, well, the Ashes are probably gone, but we could still draw this series. We don't want to lose him, especially with Archer off injured at that point as well. As it happens, if he hadn't bowled those overs, hadn't got those wickets, before close of play and then the next morning.
Crucial.
And also, they didn't score any runs against him at that point as well. Then England wouldn't have won that match.
Yep. Yeah, it was staggering. 26 overs, 3 for 52, I think, top of my head, something along those lines.
And it kind of shows that he believed the whole time, not just when in the last partnership when it seemed like there was no hope gone, but like basically from the second England bowled at 67, it didn't seem like he lost hope, I guess.
Well, this whole thing reminded me of Stokes at Perth to make his maiden Test 100 when they were chasing 520 at Perth, when they were vast gorges down the middle of the pitch anyway, after 2 days, let alone four. Stokes got 120 kind of staggering runs, really. And throughout, just thought they were going to win. And I remember interviewing him afterwards. And he says, I thought we were going to win, and Matty Pryor was going to stick with me. And it was only really after lunch when Pryor went and we were 7 or 8 down that I thought, I better kind of open my shoulders, because we were quite a way away from winning it. And he was absolutely convinced that they were just going to knock off 520 on a cracked minefield.
It's great that you'd think some of that optimism might get kind of worn away. It's very, in a youngster perhaps, but you think over a few years of international cricket, that might kind of get, yeah, as I
but
say,
when what, you're that good, when you're
but
that
he still
good.
Believes, he yeah. still believes,
yeah,
yeah. So what does it mean for the series then? I mean, although it feels like everything's going in his way, it's still 1-1. Austria still just need one win to regain the Ashes.
Retain the Ashes. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Look, over to Joe. All I would say on my part, I said a week or two ago on this show after Lords, I think we've just got to calm down. All England are so erratic, so unpredictable with the bat, that just needs Australia just to bowl them out one afternoon and the Ashes is theirs. They did do that.
Yeah.
They did it last week, and then Stokes went and carried on. I think all logic dictates that that still applies, and they only need one win from two. That said, this series is already emphatically off the hook, so it's impossible and pointless and a little bit childish to start trying to make predictions.
So my prediction, no, genuine, I was actually going to say I'm not going to bother anymore. Yeah, okay. I've made so many over the last few weeks. They rarely happen. So I think I'll just kind of sit back and enjoy it. I would say, with the kind of England optimism, Steve Smith is back. We should not forget that. And
James Anderson should be too as well, though.
Which is important, but it's nowhere near as important for England as Steve Smith coming back for Australia, I think, given that Wokes didn't have the greatest of test matches at Headingley, but I don't think you lose a huge amount between Anderson and Wokes, particularly if Anderson's not bowled for a little while. Whereas Smith, and, well, I think we're going to come on to who he should replace, that is a huge, huge difference to Australia's batting lineup, immeasurably so. And England aren't very good at getting him out.
Do you think they'll change anything, England? I mean, obviously Anderson will come in if he's fit. Do you think they'll change anything anywhere else?
We were talking about this in the office yesterday. I think my guess is they'll leave it as it is for now. I think in time, Root will slip back down to four, but I think he'll stay at three for the rest of the series.
Huge innings, that, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
For two in no time.
Yeah.
Astonishing.
Yeah. And I think to reward Denley for finally getting to 50 in this series by putting him up to open, also that Roy might have a slightly easier run at number four, which obviously there's no guarantees about that, feels a bit of a kind of hazy decision to me. So I think even though it's not ideal that Roy opens the batting because it's not worked very well so far, I think they'll stick with that. And also, I mean, Lawrence Booth wrote this for wisdom.com at the start of the series. If Roy comes off once or twice in this series, he'll probably win England a match. That is still as true now as it was when they picked him. It's not looking very likely, it has to be said, but I still think, given the options available in county cricket, given they haven't been playing much cricket recently, yep, that they'll probably stick as they are for this match.
Yeah, I would echo that, and fair play to Denley as well. I think he's slowly carving out
in his own way
his own little niche identity here within this side. You know, he's almost extravagantly solid in how he's trying to approach things, and
got double figures in 11 consecutive test innings.
Yeah, 230s at Lords, 20-odd, I think, in the... No, 12. Sorry, 12. Top score. Yeah. Top score.
20-odd? My God, that would have been nice.
Sorry, 12, yeah. And obviously, you know, a slow and vital 50, really. So fair play to him. It's great to see. It would be brilliant if he can, and I think he will now, last the series. And if he can be possibly on a winning Ashes series, you know, having now contributed a bit before I think everyone shakes hands and he's 34 years old, and perhaps that might be that for his test career. That would just be a lovely story for a proper, good, honest county cricketer.
I thought that catch at Lords was a moment as well. Obviously, in the end, it didn't really amount to much.
Great celebration as well. Yeah. He sort of threw it back in his hand.
Yeah. It was one of the great throws up of a cricket.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
He got real good distance from that angle, didn't he?
Yeah, it was class.
But it was just, even though he'd got a couple of scores in that test, it was kind of a moment where suddenly Denny was... Everyone was posting this on Twitter that Denny had done something brilliant. And I felt a bit... I mean, I like him a lot as a cricketer, and people were piling in a bit unnecessarily as well. I saw a couple of quite well-known journalists saying that he didn't have any natural talent, which seemed kind of quite shocking, really. You might say there are better people out there.
Name and shame, Joe.
No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do that. But, you know, all it takes is a couple of low scores for people to decide that there's no way they're ever good enough to play test cricket.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, what do you think about the selectors? They do have some clue what they're doing. And Denny has scored quite a few runs over the years. So give the bloke a little bit of a chance. He's had that now, and we're starting to see some rewards.
Yep. And so the other two, the players who are going to come back in, pretty much guaranteed. Anderson, straight swap for Wokes, do you both think?
I think it has to be, really. Obviously, Archer doesn't get dropped. Broad's bowled brilliantly this series. Stokes is another seamer, speaks for itself. Old Trafford as well. Big test match for Jack Leach, I think, who's done nicely in a kind of holding role so far. Old Trafford will spin and it will bounce. And it will probably do it quite quickly. Mm-hmm. So it'll be fascinating to see how he goes when the onus is a little bit more on him, perhaps, than it has been up until now.
Yeah, and Steve Smith in for...
It's difficult, isn't it? I would say it's odd because Wade has got the 100 of Khawaja, Head and Wade, the three that we assume will be weighing up here. But he's got nothing else. Head has looked the most solid to me. Khawaja's not done much, but equally, if you
who he's do got the record, yeah.
He's got the record, and also who do you bring in at number three? You don't want to move Smith up to three to push Labuschagne up to number three. Actually, it looks like he's potentially got the game to do that, but it seems like a kind of harsh reward. So I think they'll probably go with Wade dropped.
I agree with that.
I think one thing they could do is they could, it'd be really harsh on Marcus Harris, but they could push Khawaja up to open and then have Labuschagne at three, Smith at four, and keep the rest as it is. Because Khawaja's opened and succeeded in that role in Test cricket before.
It's more that, do they want Labuschagne at three?
Yeah.
I think they will try and eke out a few overs from their opening batsmen, or number two and three anyway, Harris and Khawaja. Try and eat into England's bowling attack a little bit, blunt them a little bit, blunt that new ball a little bit, hope you can survive 25, 30 overs. And then, when things are a little bit more calibrated, then Smith comes into play, then Labuschagne comes in on the back of Smith, and so on and so on. I think in a way, because Archer is a phenomenon and because England are bowling so well, especially with the new ball, it's a bit of a fool's errand, really. And so Khawaja doesn't really look like he's going to play a defining innings in this series, but he might be able to blunt England for 100 balls, 80 balls or so, get it up to lunch, stagger through to 70 for two at lunch, and then the game can play itself out after that. So I don't think they're going to shift it around. The Labuschagne's obviously a bit of a revelation coming in there at five. I agree with you, Joe. I mean, technically he looks like he could do a job further up the order, and that might happen in time, but I think at the minute they're going to win the series by piling on runs in the middle order. And so I think they'll probably keep it as it is.
One player who probably won't be playing the next test but is going to play in Australia's tour game in Derbyshire is Alex Carey, who starred in the World Cup campaign. I went down to Hampshire yesterday before his call-up to interview him. Hello, Alex. I guess the first thing I should say is happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you. Now that you're older, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I'm sure there's nothing you'd rather be doing than appearing on the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast, but have you got any plans for the evening?
Not really. I think my wife Eloise is back in Brighton, so hopefully she's got a nice dinner cooked for when I get home.
Oh, lovely. That sounds great. Okay, let's talk a bit about cricket then, Alex. What was your moment of the week?
Yeah, obviously the obvious one was the test match up in Headingley. That was pretty, I guess, as a cricket fan and lover of the game, it was exciting to watch that. Obviously, being Australian, it wasn't the ideal result, with the opportunity, I guess, to regain the Ashes. So, yeah, you know, like I said, as a cricket lover, it was quite an impressive innings from Ben Stokes to see that last wicket partnership. I got off the training track and switched it on with 70 to get, 9 down. I thought the boys had it, so credit to England. But I guess now it's for the lads to bounce back and go up to Old Trafford and hopefully, you know, win that one. But that was the obvious one. And then the other one, I guess, is playing down in Sussex. I think it's exciting now. We've got a home final.
A few runs as well.
Yeah, nice to get a few on the board, but home final next week, whenever that gets announced, which day it is. But yeah, it's exciting. A couple of weeks coming up for the Sussex Cricket Club.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that test match was just incredible. I don't think anyone's seen anything like it in test cricket. Have you ever played in a game like it in at any sort of level?
Oh, my closest ones to that was one of my first class games in Adelaide, and we were playing Western Australia, and similar thing. I think we needed to win that game and we would have got a home shield final. WA were 9 down and Ashton Agar and Michael Hogan put on 60, and got him over the line. And again, you know, 60 runs for the ninth wicket, it's quite impressive. I thought we had that one, but in terms of innings is like that, I think that, you know, that's one of the best I've seen in test cricket.
And what is it that goes through the mind of a fielding side when that's going on, because it must go pretty quickly from that thing yesterday is how, or on the other day is how quickly it changed from like Australia have got this to England a favourite kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you obviously want to take that wicket early, and the game wrapped up, and with a guy that's out there with I guess he's been in situations recently with high pressure situations, so Ben's done it before, and I guess it starts to get a little bit frustrating when you can't get the number 11 on strike, mm-hmm. and you're trying all these things and it's not quite working, and that frustration builds. And but yeah, I guess the boys tried a lot, one or two opportunities unfortunately didn't go to hand, and then the review that was late as well, so all these little things that just fell England's way.
I guess maybe it's in terms of trying to understand how cricketers recover from these things, obviously it's a different situation because there's still two games left to play, but having I guess played in a World Cup semi-final and had to kind of come back from that, I guess the question really is, how long did it take you to recover from that and sort of get over it and that sort of thing?
Oh, I guess for us that was the end of the World Cup, so it was there was no next game to worry about in terms of that, so I guess the guys again will be disappointed, but they'll have to move on pretty quickly now and rock up for the fourth test in the Ashes series again with a chance to retain the Ashes. So I'm sure they'll be motivated more than ever to bounce back from that one.
Yeah, and you in particular for that World Cup campaign, obviously you haven't. It's not been a long international career so far, although who knows what happened. But like, and that was I guess the biggest thing in it so far. And you obviously played so well during the whole tournament. What is your overriding emotions looking back on it, and what was like, I just try and put into words sort of the disappointment at the time, because I don't think people really think often about the emotions of vanquished teams and stuff. But
yeah, I guess World Cups only come around every 4 years, and I guess our preparation as the Australian cricket team was a little bit different to others. We had lots of change coming in the last 18 months to the World Cup, and lots of new faces come in and out of the team, and obviously Steve and Dave come back in, and we were really confident coming into the tournament. Personally, I was really excited to firstly be a part of a World Cup campaign for Australia in England. It's a great place to play cricket, and I guess we started really well. We had some really good momentum. One or two slip ups throughout. India beat us at the Oval pretty convincingly, and then last game at Old Trafford against South Africa would have been nice to win that one. But again, going into that semi final, we're still playing some really good cricket. We knew England were playing great cricket throughout the probably the past 3 years in the one day format. So we were confident, and I guess the first 10 overs sort of set the scene for the day up there, and Wokes bowled really well and Joffa, and we were just on the back foot early, and then from there it's with a team like England, they come out, and again that first 10 overs with the bat, they just took that momentum back. Jason Roy played really well, really positively in a smallish run chase, and it was hard to come back from there. But I guess you have all this emotion and all this build up and excitement, and you want to make the finals first, and we were good enough to do that, and then obviously you want to win the semi and then get into the big dance. But I guess after that semi it was just it was very disappointing. Reflecting on it, it was a really good achievement, I think, for the Australian cricket team to get to that semi. Like I said, there was lots of change and a different type of lead up with new coach, new playing group in that last 12 months, and it was a great effort from the boys. But you want to make it and you want to win it, and unfortunately that didn't happen for us this year.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about one particular moment in that semi final, which I guess you probably talked quite a lot about. But it was something. So Joe was saying in a press conference the other day that getting hit on the head, he said you feel a bit mugged off. And I guess what was amazing in that instance was how you got hit on the head by Joffa Archer, and instantly the narrative of the moment was turned around because you like caught the helmet before it fell on the stumps, and it was like instantly iconic, and everyone was like, this guy's a hero. I guess talk through. I mean, like right at that. That moment, I mean, were you thinking, like, I've got to catch this to stop it falling onto my stumps? Or was it just, like, a reflex? What was it like?
Yeah, no, I wish I could say it was all, I had it under control. But it was just reflex. It was, yeah, little knock, and just the buckle came undone, and yeah, I was lucky enough just to put the hand out and take my best catch of the World Cup in that moment.
Yeah, yeah. And you so you went on to get 46 in that game, and you obviously had a really good tournament in terms of just like the overall numbers. But if you look at the teams and the situations you got it in, so India, New Zealand, the two other semi-finalists, and then the brilliant knock against Africa in the game needed to win to top the group, and in a high run chase and stuff.
Yep.
I mean, do you pride yourself in being someone who likes the big stage and the tough situations and that sort of thing?
Oh, I haven't really thought of it, I guess, like that. I guess every game's a little bit different, and I suppose the pleasing thing was that when there was opportunities to be had, then, you know, I guess I sort of took those opportunities, and I guess you go out there, and I guess five down, it's you know, there's a chance to rebuild. And I guess against West Indies, there was no time pressure. I was in the 7/8 over and batting with Steve, and it was just absorbing a bit of pressure and start to build the momentum back. And Coulton Isle played an incredible innings that game, and then again against the West Indies, New Zealand, it was, you know, same sort of thing. We were five down pretty early and just battered with Usman, and you know, I guess the confidence grew for me throughout that tournament, and probably leading in against we played India in India, and then Pakistan in Dubai, and started to play a few good innings at the back end, and you know, started to feel, I guess, settled at seven, and normally the scoreboard would dictate how I needed to play, if it was rebuild or if it was go at the back end. And you know, again, I was lucky enough to play a few good innings, but you know, it would have been nicer to get us over the line at that South Africa game. I think personally, the development is to start taking the game a bit deeper and start winning games. You obviously, you see Dhoni and, you know, those likes that have played 300 plus games, but you know, it's to start to now help Australia win games and take it deep and be the, I guess, the finisher, which is a role I want to keep developing and growing into. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's interesting you mentioned your confidence growing, because I was wondering the start to your One Day career wasn't like terrible by any means, but so that first half century came up against Pakistan, it was and then into the World Cup, which was I guess a while after your debut. Was there, I guess, are you sort of a confidence player, and was there ever a stage where you sort of doubted that you kind of had all it took or anything? Or
I don't think doubted. When I came into the side, I was sort of I hadn't played a lot of innings as batting, you know, sort of six and seven in South Australia. I've sort of opened the batting there, and even in the Big Bash, it was sort of up the top of the order. So I think it's just a position, and you know, with maturity, you learn, and you start to work out what works well for me, I guess. And you know, staying calm and working with my mate at the other end, and you know, there's a lot more time than you think. And I think just through learning and being in situations in international cricket, you start to work out what's the right way to play at the time. And I guess, you know, the India and then into Pakistan, I started to feel a bit more confident in that role down the order. And you know, like I said, that, you know, that confidence built. But yeah, it was just staying calm and you know, not getting too overwhelmed with the situation, working with my mate at the other end, and keep learning. Like again, played 29 international ODIs now, and I think every time I go out and you know, get a few runs or miss out, it's an opportunity to learn. And you know, that's, again, for the next stage for me is to, like I said, is to learn and be a better finisher now for Australia.
Yeah, that's an interesting suggestion. Okay, on the AFL thing, I guess, first of all, more generally, I've always wondered how different sports are viewed in in different countries. So having played AFL and cricket both to a high level, is there a way you can sort of compare the two in terms of popularity, how they're viewed and that sort of thing?
I guess Aussie Rules is Australian based, and you know, that's the market over there, and it's you know, I love watching footy still. And then
it's close to the sort of end of the season, is it?
And there's, yeah, it's coming up to finals, so it's exciting to whack it on and watch
how your
watch
team doing?
Didn't make the finals, so but still I'll follow it and love it. Starting to get in my football over here, it's hard to escape it with being around the Sussex boys all week. But I guess with cricket, you got the opportunity to play for your country, and you know, it's pretty exciting. It's pretty cool playing for your country, and you know, I think different, obviously different types of games. One's over in, you know, a couple of hours, and then with the Test cricket, it goes for 5 days. So again, love both sports. I think, like I said, the opportunity to travel the world with cricket and play a winter down in Sussex, and then go home and play an Australian summer. And you know, the Big Bash now, it's, you know, they're getting really good crowd numbers, similar to the AFL numbers, if not more at times. So yeah, the game of cricket and T20s obviously evolved that, but like I said, playing for your country is it's quite amazing.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess, looking at your career, why did you choose AFL over cricket to begin with?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think at the time I was playing both footy and cricket, and it came to a stage where I had to make a decision, and the decision came at the back end of a footy season. So it sort of just rolled into what I was doing, and I guess that felt right at the time. And I took the opportunity to go up to Greater Western Sydney while I was starting up the club there, and you know, I really enjoyed my time there for a couple of years, and then that, you know, didn't end the way I, you know, imagined it was going to end. And I found my way out the door and back in South Australia, and probably sitting around not knowing what to do for about 6 months. And I had Tim Nielsen from the Sacker come and have a chat, and you know, offer to put some time back into my cricket. And you know, I wasn't too sure at the time if that's what I wanted to do, or, you know, really what I wanted to do. It was it all ended pretty quickly, and you know, lucky enough, I, you know, took that opportunity, and thankful for him for you know, suggesting and putting the time back into my cricket, and then yeah, back into cricket. And then it was sort of a little bit bumpy through the early stages back into cricket with a first class debut at 21, and then found my way out the door again for a couple of years, and went away and worked in finance for, you know, for 18 to 2 years. And yeah, eventually got the opportunity with the gloves at the Sacker, and you know, I'm lucky for the position I am right now. And I guess, you know, I'm really grateful that, you know, probably having, you know, a few bumps and ups and downs in that journey, and then working and then getting another opportunity, I really appreciate the position I am, and absolutely love playing, training, you know, being around cricket at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. There's quite a lot to discuss in that answer. It's a really, really interesting story, I guess. I feel like, don't like dwelling too much on these sorts of things, but the end of the AFL career. So am I right in thinking you were the captain of, is it Greater Western Sydney?
Yeah, in the under-18s. They were, yeah, starting the club, there was 18s, and then it went into a NEAFL competition, and as captain. And
then when they made the AFL, you sort of, they were like, we don't,
they delisted me then. So I had a rookie for a couple of years, and then, that was it. It all ended very quickly.
So that's, I mean, I guess you would get it in like football, I guess, when a championship club might get promoted. I don't know if that's the equivalent.
Yeah.
And then they sort of have a complete turnover of players. But yeah, it must be a really hard thing to take, I guess.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. I was playing some pretty good footy, and thought I was on the right track. And, you know, being one of the first guys there, I thought, you know, I might at least get a rookie going into that first season. And it just wasn't to be. That, like you said, there was a lot of turnover, there was a lot of new faces, and they had a lot of draft picks. Found my way out the door, unfortunately. There was, I was always told I was a little bit too slow and not quite big enough, and all these things. But yeah, again, I love the opportunity up there. I think I learned a lot about myself. Had to grow up pretty quickly, moving away from home and living in Western Sydney for a couple of years. And I think the work ethic of AFL players is something that I'm grateful to, you know, just be around for a couple of years. And now, hopefully, you know, putting that back into the cricket is, it's pointing me in the right direction for sure.
Yeah. What do you think you'd be doing now if it wasn't for the call from Tim Nielsen?
Great question. Not sure. I always thought I'd be an electrician at times, and then I was found myself in finance for a couple of years, and I don't really know. I guess I always knew that I wanted to to play professional sport, footy and cricket, and those couple of years when I was working, I worked pretty hard to get back into the standard that I guess I was always wanted to play at, and I was lucky enough just to get the opportunity to have that second chance. And like I said, it's to keep learning, keep working hard, and as I know, it can all end pretty quickly. So I understand the opportunity I got, and for me, it's to, like I said, keep working hard at it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, cool. Thanks. Thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
I hope you have a good rest of your birthday. thank you.
No, thanks for having me on.
Good. Okay. Well, there has actually been other Test cricket going on around this world this week as well, with a series concluding in Sri Lanka and just getting underway in the West Indies. And another guest, wisdom writer Manoj Narayan, speaking over the phone from Bangalore, has been keeping a close eye on both. Hello, Manoj. What's your moment of the week?
Hi, Ben. Well, you've certainly picked a good week to ask me for my moment. Well, there were plenty, weren't there? There was the winning run moment at Headingley. I really liked Leach wiping his glasses before every ball. I was very impressed by Stokes bowling non-stop, over that evening. Even looking at the other tests, there was Bumrah's 5 for 7, which was incredible. And there was something weird in Bolt dropping an absolute sitter against De Silva. If I had to pick one moment, I think it would be Stokes reverse sweeping line six. That's the winning moment. That's when Stokes got into Australia's heads, I think. Because it wasn't just, they realized that it wasn't just a matter of taking a wicket. They had someone with the force of personality like Stokes at the other end, who was batting on another zone altogether. And I would even go so far as to say that shot had such an effect on Lyon that at some subliminal level, he was so short of confidence, and that maybe, saw him fumble that run out.
So let's talk about that that India-West Indies game, I guess. As you say, Bumrah was brilliant in that final innings, but I guess that's sort of to be expected.
Bumrah is expected now. Bumrah is expected to be that brilliant every time he goes out. And he had his... it's been a month and a bit since the World Cup. He's had his rest. So, Bumrah is expected to do that. I think the one thing that Bumrah did in that match, I think, is bowl outswingers. I didn't see a lot of it because, the match happens at an odd hour in India. But, apparently he's developed a good outswinger, and that's going to make him even more dangerous.
Yeah, okay. And I guess, so if that was expected, maybe the runs from Ajinkya Rahane weren't, so it's been a long time coming. He looked so good on those tours of England and Australia.
He
averaged 32 in 2017 and 2018 combined. I guess the question is, what happened, and is he back to his best?
It's too soon to say if he's back to his best, because what was really striking about Rahane over the last year was... See, he's always been India's sort of go-to player in away tests and overseas tests. But in England last year, and even in Australia, you could see that, he was struggling a lot. I think he managed just one half century in 5 tests in England. And I think similarly in Australia, he just managed one half century in 4 tests, which isn't great for someone who is supposed to be India's specialist in overseas tests. But since then, he's gone off on a break. He's played some first-class cricket with Hampshire. He's scored a century and a half century on his comeback. And you also saw a sort of different side to Rahane this time. It wasn't that counter-attacking sort of innings that he usually does. He was a lot more solid. He was a lot more cautious. He hung back, waited for the bad balls, We'll have to wait and see whether he's back to his best. It depends on whether he can do this in the second test and then again South Africa later this year.
Yeah.
But it's good.
So I guess a lot of strong performances in that game as well. Ishant Sharma did it with bat and ball, and Jadeja played a really important role too. He was picked over Ashwin, who's obviously got such a brilliant test record. Did that call surprise you? Was it the right one?
It definitely surprised me, because Ashwin's always been India's, you know, strike bowler, especially overseas. And overseas, because not all batsmen are used to sort of facing the sort of smart off-spin bowling Ashwin is so potent with. And it's surprising, because he was really good last year. It was not a matter of a loss of form either, as in he was very good in that one test he played in Adelaide against Australia. He picked up 3 wickets in each innings and it was extremely economical. I think it could be a matter of his fitness, because if you think back to that Southampton test against England last year, he was compared to Moeen Ali, who was superb that test. But Ashwin couldn't sort of play to his full strength because he had a groin problem. And I think that resurfaced in Australia, and he was injured for the rest of the series. So maybe the management is thinking, let's go with someone like Jadeja, who does, you know, get wickets. He is superb with the bat, and he's much better in the field as well. And even though Jadeja didn't really do much with the ball in this first test in Antigua, he did contribute with the bat. And there's Kuldeep Yadav as well, who I think Shastri earlier this year said was now India's go-to spinner overseas, which is certainly bad news for Ashwin. So it'll be interesting, I guess, to see if even if India go with 2 spinners the next test, whether Ashwin makes it or not.
Yeah, okay. Any other changes India could make? Pant for Saha or anything, or anything like that?
I would like to see Rohit back in there. I know Vihari got the nod over him, and I really like Vihari. I hope he does well. But Rohit has had a good year, so I would, you know, like to see if he seems to have really come a long way in generally in international cricket. So I would like to see how I know he's had a long rope in Test cricket, but I would like to see him in there and see what he makes of it.
Yeah, okay, cool. So let's talk about the other Test series going on at the moment. Sri Lanka v New Zealand, where New Zealand won by an innings level the series. It looks like they were just sort of brilliant in that game, basically. There was loads of time lost to rain, and Sri Lanka had won the first, so they had to win the second. And they basically just played it kind of to perfection in terms of how they paced everything in that game.
Yeah. And see, the thing with New Zealand is I always, you know, I'm guilty of this, but I was live blogging the match for ICC and I realized I kept thinking that every time Williamson and Taylor got out, I kept thinking, oh, that's it. That's the innings right there. But that is so wrong, because they have really good batsmen in Latham. They're bottling incredible. And I think even if you look at the rankings, you see Williamson's third. I think Latham is now 8. Taylor's 12. And they have a really good team. So I don't think they're no longer, you know, it's unfair to say they are punching above their weight or anything like that. It's they're just a proper good team. And it was no surprise what they did, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess most importantly from that series, with that being an exciting game and the first game being exciting, it's just Test cricket and the World Test Championship is alive and kicking, I guess.
Yeah, it's certainly sort of given context to Test cricket you would like to think that New Zealand would still have gone for victory on that final day in Colombo if it wasn't for the points at stake, but I'm sure that played a part. I'm sure that sort of drove them to, you know, get those 60 points and even things up, because otherwise it's 120 points they've lost, and yeah, that's not a good way to start the Test Championship. So I think the World Test Championship is doing what it intended to do.
Great. Well, thanks very much for joining us, Manoj, and I hope the rest of the Indian series is an exciting one.
Thanks, Ben. Yeah. Cool.
Right, Phil and Joe, what are your non-Headingley moments of the week? Let's start with Joe.
My moment of the week was actually really big news that kind of got lost in amongst the kind of the Ashes hysteria or drama, which was Mark Robinson leaving his role as England women coach. 4 years in the job, only won the World Cup 2 summers ago. So to leave now, and got them to a World T20 final only a few months ago, to leave now, I think took people by surprise, especially with a World T20 around the corner. I think most people thought he'd see them through to that and then perhaps step down. It seems, and I don't know myself, but there seems to be some difference of opinion about whether he was pushed or whether he wanted to go. The wording of the statement saying he was leaving was that he'd stepped down, which suggests a resignation. But then Claire Connor's quote said that they mutually agreed that the time was come for him to move on. If I was in Mark Robinson's shoes, I would think this is probably quite a good time to go. I think it's having won that World Cup, he's done a fantastic job in that role. We've seen the massive chasm in quality between Australia and England over this summer. I'm not sure what more he can achieve in this role at this current time. That's not to be said we can't catch Australia. Obviously we can, but there are some systemic issues that need to be sorted out before then, which Phil and Raf Nicholson covered in the last Wisden Cricket Monthly. So I can see, if he stepped down, I can see why he'd want to do that. If he's been pushed, I'm a bit surprised by that. I think he deserved a chance at the World T20 if he wanted it. There's been some criticism that he hasn't used young players particularly well. Sophia Dunkley hasn't played at all this summer for England, hasn't got any runs at all in the Kia Super League. So perhaps you can understand why Robinson hasn't gone that way. But there does seem to be a feeling that he hasn't pushed youth as much as he might have done this summer, particularly against the Australians when things weren't going their way.
Yeah, that's one of the constructive criticisms that Raf Nicholson makes in the current issue of the magazine. And it's a criticism that we've read here and there as well regarding how Robinson did things, that it was quite a closed clique and they would practice inter-squad games at Loughborough in effect. And with good reason, Robinson didn't really trust the county game as being fit for purpose to produce ready-made international cricketers. That said, Raf also made the point presciently that it would be a terrible mistake if England were to part ways with Robinson, and she wrote that a fortnight before they did. I tend to agree with you, Joe. I think in Robinson's heart, he may well be thinking this is no bad time to go. But I'm very, very surprised that England have appeared to be so comfortable in letting him go, because there's not going to be garlanded candidates behind him. I don't necessarily.
It'll be fascinating to see who they go for. Has there been much rumours? I haven't seen much names talked about.
As you say, people have just been caught up in other things, haven't they? But yeah,
I'm interviewing Charlotte Edwards in a couple of days, so I might ask her.
Yeah. Okay.
But genuinely, I mean, will it be an ex-player? Will it be a female cricketer? Ex-female cricketer. Very good chance, you'd imagine.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm going to ask her.
Yeah,
and,
cool.
And probably get nothing back, but we shall see.
I guess the other thing about Mark Robinson is his leaves with his reputation pretty much intact, but also there's going to be other jobs coming up with England. He probably isn't in line for that England head coach role, but someone's going to get that job, and he could easily be in line to get there.
So it's going
to
be
a bit of a merry-go-round and stuff.
And certainly the next big county job that comes up, he'll be right in the mix for that.
The 100 round the corner.
Yeah,
good point. Yeah,
thanks, Ben.
Cool. So, Phil, what's your moment of the week?
Non-Leeds moments of the week.
Right? Non-Headingley moments of the week.
Yeah. Ravi Bapara made a vintage 40-odd not out on the TV last week.
Yeah. I saw this one as well.
Yeah, I think he made 45 and he played a shot over extra cover off Rhys Topley that was that would enter into the Ravi Hall of Fame, of which there are plenty, of course. It's worth checking out. Slightly short of length outside off stump, and he kind of rocks back but stays in the shot and then just whips it over extra cover. Ravi is alive and well, folks. Don't worry about that.
Bang at six, though, Phil. What's that all about?
Well,
he wasn't bowling either in that game because he's not fit.
He's a bit in and out. But also, you know, Dhoni's batted 5 and 6, hasn't he, in these T20 games. And Ravi brings, obviously, a sharp mind and a slow heartbeat to these occasions.
Sure. I mean, Dhoni did have a few more people above him in the top order than Essex. I don't want to diminish the
Essex have got a good side, and they won this game. They had to win it to stay in the blast mix. Sussex hadn't lost a game all year. Brilliant side, Sussex. Most people's favourites. And Essex went down to Hove and won the game. Mo Amir took a couple up top. Simon Harmer is now the captain, and he finished it off. Brilliant catch at short extra cover to win the game, to ice the game, in effect. And it does mean that we have this bizarre situation in the going into the last 3 days of the tournament, with some teams still to play two games, but most only playing one on Friday night, with 7 of the 9 teams in the South Division still able to qualify.
Oh, well, so Sussex have qualified, yeah, and I'm the Morgan around, yeah.
So 8 of the 9 still in with a mix, with one already qualified. So 7 of the 9 could still make it or not, which is extraordinary, really.
Long live the blast.
Well, indeed.
The South Group does indeed. This, right? Was it last year a similar thing happened, or 2 years ago, where basically everyone, I think literally everyone was still in the mix going into the last game, maybe last year, maybe
yeah.
2 years ago.
Yeah, because I remember maybe putting together a helping put together a who needs what, and we kind of just gave up because it's like, well, everyone can still do it, and yeah, no one's got it in their own hands, sort of thing.
Yeah, it's great to see. It's a lot more cut and dried in the North Group.
Yeah. In the North Group, Lancashire, Derbyshire, and Nottinghamshire are all through, and only Northants have a theoretical chance of hauling in Worcestershire, but even that looks unlikely.
It's a long shot. Okay.
Yeah. And then we had a round of county championship games, which were just kicking off during our last weekly pod, but yeah, exciting stuff in there as well.
Yeah, so I wanted to double up on the Essex story. Sorry, it's all too predictable, but they've now won, I think, 8 in 9. Which is extraordinary when you think how difficult it is to win 4 day games of cricket in that top division. And they kind of did in England, really, that they were way behind on first innings. They were 90 for 7 at one point, responding to 227 from Kent, down in Canterbury. They clawed up to 114, but dead in the water, really, on a juicy track. And then Sam Cook took 7 for 23 and bowled Kent out for 40. Even then, Essex was struggling at one point, knocked it off in the end with just 3 wickets in hand, laid down the gauntlet, and then Somerset, who were also behind in their game, and it is increasingly a two-horse race now. Yorkshire are third, but I think they're probably gone.
Although Yorkshire plays Somerset in their next game, so if they win that and Essex lost, then it would squeeze quite a bit.
Right, okay.
But they need to, Yorkshire would need to win their last three, and Essex would need to lose at least twice.
Right, okay. So it's barely a puncher's chance for Yorkshire, yeah. But they're not strictly out. Okay, but Somerset were again behind in that one, and they managed to pull it around. I think a three-figure deficit on first innings. Mm-hmm. And then they chased 258 to win it in the fourth as well. So
it's, yeah, two young guns. Well, George Bartlett, Tom
yeah,
Banton getting the runs.
Yeah, and Tom Banton, 67, I think he got, which is great to see because obviously he is one of the big stories of this year. Frighteningly talented T20 opener, but now he's getting runs at 5 in Championship cricket, 4th innings runs as well. That's great to see for him. It's all bubbling up to the finale down in Taunton at the end of September. Jack Leach will be back from England, and Simon Harmer is unstoppable. And as he said to us in the magazine this month, he thinks he's the best off spinner in the world. So Taunton not afraid to lay a certain slab of tarmac that's going to go.
Yeah,
that's going to go sideways. It could be an absolute tear up, really. So I'm going to be heading down for that one for sure.
Yeah, I can't really remember a title race like it. We've obviously had really exciting ones, but then those tend to be when like lots of games are losing if you and you have a few teams in the mix. I can't remember two such high quality teams going neck and neck. It's almost like last year in the Premier League with Liverpool and Man City, like each team keeps winning difficult games and the other team keeps coming back and doing the same.
It is, which is great in a way as well, because obviously in the Premier League football we know that's because clubs have much bigger resources than others, so you've just got that gap. There's nothing with Somerset and Essex to say they should be the top two. If anything, it should be Notts and Surrey, who are right down the bottom.
Two non-test match grounds.
And Warwickshire as well, yeah.
Yeah, and we sat here a few months ago, Lizzie Ammon, who knows more about county cricket than anyone, tipped Notts to win it. Notts are down with the Rovers. They're out for the count. So it is gloriously unpredictable. And obviously my heart is with Essex, but if Somerset were to do it for the first time in their history, then that would be just as glorious, really.
Yeah, and in Division 2, just as exciting with 3 promotion spots and loads of teams still in the mix. Joe, how's that shaping up?
It's shaping up to a very, very exciting finish. This kind of almost involves everyone in the division. So the performance of the last round in Division 2 was definitely Gloucestershire, who chased down 263 in 47 overs at Derby to move into second place, 19 points clear of fourth place, which is Glamorgan. And remember, this year, 3 teams are going up. So Gloucestershire have put themselves in a really strong position. but Northants, Glamorgan, Durham, Sussex still very much in the mix. Middlesex even possibly in the mix if they can win their last three. And what we've talked about this before on the podcast, but what's great here is that we've got a few counties that really we wouldn't anticipate being anywhere near the promotion mix-up, being right up there fighting for that First Division status. Phil, you're going to Gloucester to see what's been going on in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I am, because it's a story that's crept up on me a little bit, because one does have that tendency to fall into that kind of preconception that certain teams focus their energies on more immediate survival cricket, T20 cricket, 50 over cricket, the kind of cricket that gets people through the turnstiles and gets better prize money, and that sometimes, rightly or wrongly, maybe the 4-day game is prioritised slightly differently. Gloucester, for the last few years, have fallen into that category, unavoidably so. So to see them turning it around this year, and very much in the mix, probably favourites to go up now, and to be crucially producing young players, young good players. James Bracey, Chris Dent is a sleeping giant of county cricket. No one's ever talked about him in terms of higher honours, and yet he churns runs out time after time. And there is a kind of English core led by a very good English coach in Richard Dawson, who I know a little bit. He used to work with me, funnily enough.
Did work experience at our old magazine, right?
Did work experience at All Out Cricket magazine way back when.
All downhill from there.
Whatever happened to him, mate. So it's great. It's a really heartening English cricket story. So I'm going to go down to try and explain how they're doing it. And hopefully they'll be able to join the Essex-Somerset story and to flesh out that top division with a few more non-test match grounds.
Yeah. Sorry, what I should have added as well, Lancashire are top of that division and well clear and are all but promoted. I don't think I mentioned that in my...
And Haseeb Hameed has been released.
Yes.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about that last week, did we? Now,
we talked about him in the context of... Actually, Ben, remember, we're talking about Ben Duckett and his struggles, and obviously they've had similar kind of chronology in terms of early promise England career, and it's fallen by the wayside dramatically so in Hameed's case. But I think I saw Graham Onion's tweet, really sorry to see him go, but I think this is best for all concerns.
Really?
And I think he's got that kind of bang on there. I think something had to change, didn't it? And it'll be fascinating to see where he's going. We've heard rumours of Yorkshire, and then we've heard that that's definitely not happening. So who knows?
Yeah.
But that would be an extraordinary transfer that did happen.
Yeah, I have to say, just on the three teams going up, and they've fiddled about this a lot in recent years, I really like the way it's going to be. I know it's going to be really odd in the top tier with not each team playing each other team twice, but I think that it's going to mean you don't get this sort of like quite big set of teams in Div 2 who are just there and like exchanging positions between fourth and the bottom every year with like no hope of getting promoted. And it means the teams in the top tier can kind of plan a bit more into the future rather than always having to be fighting for survival with two going down. So I get why it looks bad, but I think this is now the right way around. Yeah, so we should talk about a few other things in the world of cricket. Scotland and Oman got their Cricket World Cup League 2 campaigns off to strong starts. Each took 6 points from a tri-series, also involving PNG north on the border. Sri Lanka have confirmed they will tour Pakistan just over 10 years on from the terrorist attack on their team bus. Yeah,
Test series?
I think it's all three formats, yeah. So that'll be the return of Test cricket to Pakistan, and a wonderful way to do it with same team. I think it's spread into a few blocks towards the end of this year. So they're doing one of the series and then returning for a couple more.
Well, that would be stunning. Zimbabwe went there a couple of years ago, and the response from the locals was immense, as you'd expect.
Yeah, there's been a little bit, but this feels like the proper return, I guess.
Test match back on Pakistani soil would be phenomenal.
And it has been heading this way, but I get Wazim Khan obviously took that role at the PCB quite relatively recently and said this is one of the main things he was pitching for, and he seems to have done it pretty quickly. So I mean, obviously a big operation at work, but some impressive stuff from Wazim Khan in that role.
And should we end with Bermuda? Bermuda have qualified for the men's T20 World Cup qualifier ahead of much fancied USA. It's a bit of a blow for the States after they secured ODI status not long ago, and seemed like a team in the rise. But what a story for Bermuda.
Delray Rawlins.
Yeah, Sussex's Lana Delray Rawlins.
As he likes to be known.
Kamal Leverock.
So he played, did he? Went out there.
Yeah.
Oh, great stuff. A lot of talent, that kid.
Yeah, Kamal Leverock, as in nephew of.
Lovely.
Malachy Jones, who was
the bowler.
Yeah, the 17-year-old. He nicked off
Robbie Tapper. He's still playing.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, no, he's batting at three. just on Rawlins as well, it doesn't affect his England eligibility at all, but it's still a nice move from Sussex to let him go. And
how
and
come
that
is
in the
because
middle of Spain? Because they're an associate team, right, so okay. There's no sort of cooling off period between playing for an associate and moving to a full member.
And it's great that he's prepared to miss some blast games, which are a big deal in county cricket, to go and play for his home country as well.
Yeah, and it's a lovely spot to end it on, I think. So I hope you've enjoyed listening. Thanks Joe for coming on.
Thanks Ben.
Thanks Phil.
Thanks Ben.
Right, I've been Ben. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast, and if you enjoyed it, please subscribe on all available platforms and tell your friends.